Hello, this is John Goldthorpe, your host for In Dialogue with Nature, our podcast of readings, conversations, and lecture presentations that explore, clarify, and deepen our understanding for the possibilities of an ever-growing conscious and caring relationship with nature and one another. Today's podcast is a recording of a talk entitled Living in the Present, Practices for Being in and with Nature, given by Ryan Shea, an associate researcher and educator at the Nature Institute. Ryan describes the locus of his talk this way. Most wisdom traditions in the world, East and West, ancient and modern, have taught the centrality of living in the present. Yet, in our daily lives of distraction and hectic frenzy, we often find that the one place we never are is here, and the one time we never have is now. How can one start living fully in presence? This talk explores ways in which we might receive this capacity directly from nature by working through several concrete practices with plant and animal teachers. Now, here is Ryan Shea.
Hello. Welcome. So my talk, as you probably know because you're here, is called Living in the Present, Practices for Being in and with Nature. So I want to just begin with a sort of symphonic chorus of some quotes. You'll notice commonalities as I go through. Here's one from Annie Dillard, a writer who wrote the wonderful Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. What we are doing this hour and that one is what we are doing, including being here. Seneca, going back quite a ways, a couple thousand years, Greek philosopher, Western tradition, true happiness is to enjoy the present without anxious dependence upon the future, not to amuse ourselves with either hopes or fears, but to rest satisfied with what we have, which is sufficient. For he that is so wants nothing. Matthew 6:34, Sermon on the Mount from that Jesus fellow. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Contemporary Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. Breathing in, I calm body and mind. Breathing out, I smile. Dwelling in the present moment, I know this is the only moment. Turning to the last two, pertaining directly to the Nature Institute, Thinking Like a Plant, by Craig Holdridge. He quotes in here the 20th century educational philosopher John Dewey, who spoke about the treacherous idea of educating for the future instead of in the present. This is what Dewey says, and then Craig comments. When preparation is made the controlling end of education, then the potentialities of the present are sacrificed to a supposititious future. When this happens, the actual preparation for the future is missed or distorted. The ideal of using the present simply to get ready for the future contradicts itself. The ideal of using the present simply to get ready for the future contradicts itself. It omits and even shuts out the very conditions by which a person can be prepared for his future. We always live at the time we live and not at some other time. And only by extracting at each present time the full meaning of each present experience, are we prepared for doing the same in the future? This is the only preparation which in the long run amounts to anything. So Dewey. Craig comments, in other words, real learning occurs through people engaging in experiences that are meaningful in and of themselves. In this way, growth occurs and we can interact more fully, be present, and creatively engaged with what comes to meet us in new situations in the future. And this comes at the end of Craig's book, and the final section, right after what I read, is just called Learning from Genuine Presences. And finally, Goethe, the present alone is our happiness. That was me massively smushing down the amount of quotes that I wanted to do. You could literally, obviously, spend the entirety of our 50 minutes together just reading from all different traditions, East, West, present, modern. All of them often will say things incredibly similar to this, advocating that we live in the present, that we live in the now, the here and now. And often, they will give you some instructions for how to do this. So tonight, I want to share with you some of the ways that I've attempted to do this. So living in the present is strange. The first strange thing I found about it, years ago when I first started getting really pulled and drawn to Buddhist meditation, Thich Nhat Hanh in particular, and started practicing mindfulness meditation, breath meditation, is, as I said in the advertisement, the one place you never are is here, the one time you never are is now. And we often feel that, but that's, in a way, it's striking and bizarre and weird. How could you not be exactly where you are and when you are? Why do you need to work so hard to do something that it seems impossible to not do? The other way of saying it is, when you're trying to live in the present, what are you actually trying to do? What's the thing you feel like you're not getting? What's the failure that you're failing to accomplish that these exercises and works and practices are supposed to be overcoming? So that's the thing I was struggling with. And I kept having these difficulties in working, especially with various practices, Eastern practice, Buddhist practices, but also ancient Greek Stoic practices. Something kept feeling missing. And when I came back to a lot of the Goethean work that I had done when I was younger and was trying to get into, I found that what the Goetheans do is actually what I was looking for in living in the present. They just often wouldn't put it like that. So what is it that we're feeling a lack of? I feel like the easiest way to see the lack is first in human ways. So I asked my daughter's permission to use her as an example. For anybody that's interacted with children, the first thing that you know is that they constantly demand your attention, right? All the time when you're with them, from the time when they're young, they're doing it, but from the time they can talk, they're constantly saying, look at me, listen to me. They grab your face and they say, pay attention to me, right? They do this literally all the time. I know. And what you feel when you're a parent in your better moods, when you're not just frustrated, is that their request for you to pay attention to them is just because the amount of attention that you've paid to them is not sufficient. There's more to them there than you were paying attention to. There was more dignity than you were doing justice to. And that's what they were calling you out on. That's why they said, pay attention to me. They were saying, I'm more than you're here for right now. And that's, I think, the core issue, which is evidenced, I think, too, if you listen to a lot of the ways that people talk now. One of the main things that people say they want in interacting with other people is to be heard or to be seen. So if you have a really good interaction, you might say afterwards, I really felt seen by them. That's it. Not that they agreed with you, not that they're going to work with you, not that they ever want to see you again, but you just felt like they were present enough and actually paying attention to you and not waiting for their turn to talk and not waiting to solve your problem, right? And I think that at its heart, that's what at least my craving is, why a line like living in the present or trying to live in the present is so appealing to me, is because you feel, I feel a constant failure to have paid sufficient attention to what's around, right? But the trees can't actually grab your face and turn you towards them, so you have to do some of the work yourself. So most of the time tonight, I want to be going through just some of the things that I've been working with. But a couple preliminary words to set us up for that. What might it not mean to live in the present? I'll tell a little story, just to have it in our minds. A lot of the quotes that I gave, especially the Seneca quote and this quote from Dewey that was in Craig's book, we tend to think of living in the present as being opposed to other things, right? Specifically the past and the future. So to live in the present means you're not consumed by worries about the past of what happened yesterday. It means you're not overwhelmed with planning tomorrow. So if right now, right, you start to drift off a little bit and you start to think about what you have to do later tonight or what's required of you later, or you start having to pay your bills, then we say, I need to switch back and be in the present. So we tend to think of living in the present as not thinking about the past and not thinking about the future. So here's a story. The neurologist Oliver Sacks, some of you may have heard of him, he has a famous book called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, saw this musicologist as a case once when he was working in a hospital who had had a stroke, and as a result of that, he had what Sacks described as the worst case of amnesia that he had ever encountered and that had ever been documented. The guy's name was Clive Wearing. His reset on amnesia was between 7 and 30 seconds. So if you would go to talk to him, he would say, hello, nice to meet you. You would have between a 7 and 30 second conversation, and then he would stop and pause, and his eyes would look like they reset, and he would say, hello, nice to meet you, and that would go on repeat over and over and over again. And you can hear an audio story of this online in an early episode of Radiolab where they're interviewing him, and his wife is there, and she's trying to help him think and understand what's going on. And she says, no, you're still yourself, you just don't remember it. And he starts getting angry, and he says, if I don't remember it, it didn't happen to me. I wasn't there if I can't remember it. So then, to help him, she gave him a journal to start writing it down in the hopes that this would start creating a through-line narrative. And then she came back a while later and looked at the journal, and it was hundreds of pages of him writing, I have just woken up right now. This is the first thing that I am writing. I don't know where I am. I have just woken up. Line, no, disregard previous. I have just woken up right now. Over and over and over again for hundreds of pages. That is a man living in a present, completely divorced from the past and the future. And I'll leave it to you to think if that is a desirable state and if that's what we are trying to achieve by living in the present, or perhaps there would be another word for describing that sort of state. But it's fascinating, right, when you think about it, when you hear of a case like that and you realize, oh, right, well, of course, I couldn't mean then by the present avoiding the past and future. But there's some way in which worrying about things that have already happened and anticipatorily worrying about things that are going to happen mess with my ability and my ability to pay attention to my children, to my wife, to what I'm saying right now, to trees when I go outside, to insects when I'm looking at them. So what are we actually doing, right? If we want to attend better, but we don't want to be in Clive Wearing's, let's call it hellish, state of eternal presence. So I'll make two preliminary, I'll call them suggestions instead of claims, and then I just want to spend my time going through some encounters I had. So my two suggestions are, first one, to put it somewhat pugnaciously, living in the present in itself is impossible. I'll make that as a claim. What do I mean by that? So the reason I put it like that is the founders of the School of Phenomenology like to point out that you can never remember as such. You always are remembering something specific that happened to you. You can't just remember, right? You can never see as such. You're always looking at some particular thing or other, right? And when you stop looking at one thing, you're looking at something else. You can never think. You're always thinking about something in particular. And so in this same way, when we say living in the present, the literature, often things like all the quotes that I just read, they make it sound like it's this on-off switch where it's something we do in ourselves where we can either not live in the present or work hard, flip a switch, and now we're living in the present. And those are the two states. But what I want to suggest is it's something more like an infinity of different possible ways in which you can live in the present. So how do you live in the present? There isn't an answer to that. There might be an infinity of answers. We won't do infinity tonight. We'll do five short ones. And the second one, going off of this Clive Wearing story of the eternal present, is whatever we mean by living in the present, it has to mean depth, right? Not a present as opposed to other things, but going in a present that can kind of combine things together in some way. So those are my two suggestions. So let's get into specifics. So I've been generally interested in most parts of the natural world, but the things that I think are particularly appealing to me are plants and insects. And part of the reason is simply because they're cool and fascinating. But another one is they're all over the place, right? If you want to make an effort to be present to things, they are actually accessible, right? Almost all the time. Even in winter, their plants are still there. The insects go into hiding a little bit, but you could still dig them up if you really wanted to. And so they're available as something that you can go out to. And I was particularly interested in trying to see the different ways in which you encounter plants and insects, right? What sort of attention do they demand? So even, again, think of a different people you know. The type of attention demanded by my 6-year-old daughter in her hyper-specificity is very different from the type of attention demanded by my 1-year-old son in his hyper-specificity, right? To be with each of them is a very, very different thing. And so to be with a plant and with an insect is different. So my suggestion is, in this idea that you can't live in the present, is that each individual kind of natural being requires its own mode of attention and devotion and presence. And that it will, if you approach it, kind of teach you how to do that. So, first, this summer, starting around the time that I started working here, my daughter was going to a short day program from 9 to noon, and it was 30 minutes away. It was down in Philmont. It was 30 minutes away from where I live, so I couldn't drive back home. So I would strap my little 1-year-old son to my back, and we'd go for a 3-hour hike in High Falls in Philmont every day. So from 9:10 to 11:50, from around mid-March to June, I would walk the same path every day, slowly, for around 3 hours. One, because it's enjoyable, but two, what I had a particular mind for was what sorts of things are showing up and how, right? And it's during springtime, so part of the difficulty is there's just too much. I already limited it, right? I'm not paying attention to atmospheric conditions, meteorological things. I'm not paying attention to the birds. I was still just trying to focus on plants and insects. But even there, from one day to the next and one week to the next, these profusions would happen where the plants would just start springing up all over the place. And so I found myself, in a way, preparing attention, but then being guided to things that were growing quickly. But the first point to note, obviously, is for being in the present, you do, in a very basic way, have to go somewhere at some time, not anywhere at any time, right? And walking the same path every day at the same time, that's when you start actually noticing some changes. And one of the plants that caught my attention, the general class of these things called the ephemerals, right? These spring things that come up, things like trout lily, and one of the things that is beautiful and interesting and catches most people's attention is trillium, right? So a lot of you might have seen this single little spindle stem comes up, and then the red trillium, which is, there's tons of it, high falls, then these three large leaves kind of spade-shaped, forming a nice little circle, and then stem continues, and then three sepals, more angular, and then crosswise, three petals perfectly fitting through into the three sepals, then six stamens, and then three pistils. You get this very nice, repeating, simple, beautiful, striking structure, and they grow very quickly. They just kind of pop up, and they're ephemeral. They just sort of pass away. And so when you start attending to them, the most obvious sense of trying to be present to something is this sense of being now, right? So again, think of Clive Wearing, living in the now. And when you look at the trillium and you try to live in the now, the striking thing about it is you only really notice it by going there several days in a row and several weeks in a row. What you notice is that it wasn't there and then it grew really quickly. So to live with it right now is actually only really possible when you are seeing it connected to what you have already experienced before and what you anticipate will happen later. But you might be wrong in your anticipation, right? If you didn't know, one, that it was called ephemeral, which, you know, hint is in the name, you might suspect that it would just be there like a lot of other plants for a very long time. You wouldn't know that very quickly the flower will pass away, and not that long after that, the leaves won't last that long either. Then when you live into the cycle of that, now becomes not only not the individual point in time, it's all of the time that you spent with it seeing it change, but also the name ephemeral means you are not only contextualizing the time in the time you spent with it, but within the time of the year, right? To enter into the now of a trillium is to enter into its time gestalt, as one Goethean researcher would put it, right? So it has its visual space gestalt, this very striking threefold structure that's very appealing, but it also has a very striking time gestalt as well, right? In the same way that you enter into music through the temporal structure, to enter into this particular plant is, it comes, right, in early spring, it lasts for a little bit, and then it passes away. Then you learn a little bit more, and you find out, oh, actually, like a lot of these ephemerals, it's rhizomatic. It has these little stems underneath the ground that you can dig up, and a lot of the different little trilliums that you see are all connected underground, right? And now you can enter into what it means for it to be now, not merely in it springing up, but the rhizome is still there, right? So even right now, if you go walking in High Falls, it's not just notionally there. You can dig up underground and there are trillium rhizomes under there, right? So when you enter into its presence in the now, it's not just here right now, and it's not just its time cycle, it's the through line in it, right? And so strikingly, being with something that's literally called ephemeral forces you to change the idea of living in the temporal now, from resisting the past, resisting the future, to seeing the point that you're at, looking at this trillium, is binding the past and the future together in a very specific, again, time gestalt, a very specific time pattern or melody or rhythm, which is very different from what you would have to do with another plant, right? So think most strikingly, if you tried to do the same thing with a redwood, right? And you tried to live into the way in which it is in time over its cycle, and you wanted to return every day throughout its entire life cycle, that would require us, yeah, you would have to take care of your health. And you can start to feel that, even if you're just looking at the way that you temporally engage with different plants, they demand that you enter into different times, in the same way that, right, if you are listening to a Chopin nocturne, or if you're listening to a waltz, you have to enter into different time, otherwise you're not with the pieces, right? So the same with plants. And so, ironically, something called ephemeral starts to reveal the now, not as the opposition to the past and the future, but more like what the medievals would say when they said, the now, the present, the now is the point at which eternity touches time. That's the way that they put it. Or, see if you can hear a similarity, Goethe said this, hold fast to the present. Every circumstance, every instance is of infinite value, for it is the representative of an entire eternity. And so what you learn already then is it takes you into this deep sense of the now, or a sort of deep time through its ephemerality. And again, I would say, this isn't merely something relevant to the red trillium. This is a lesson you can learn from that, that you then is the way that you would engage with everything differently. Also, when I was at High Falls, the profusion is a bit, yeah, I mean, it's just overwhelming. If you're actually trying to pay attention to plants and not merely walk through and forest bathe, and you're trying to take track of what's coming out, which I was doing, and when it was still pretty frozen, it was exciting because you can kind of keep track of stuff, and you get really excited about this bud here and that bud there, and there's a little sprout coming out adventitiously, and you get really excited, and you go over and look at it, and then you come the next week, and there's 20,000 of them, and then you get a bit overwhelmed, and you get called down, maybe, as I was, to the water just to take a little break. There's a nice stream there. And nicely, the water, right, it has a nice, simple unity that the water brings together. It's rocky. There's a rocky bed under the water and extending out into the bank. So there are still plants there. There are just fewer plants. And so you can kind of cool down a little bit and just sit there and let yourself attend a little bit more easily to a few things that show up. In the place that we would go to, I started noticing out in the middle of the water, first, there's this little rocky island. These little sprouts started coming up that looked like little red asparagus. And then a couple more of them came up, and then they started growing, and then they started unfolding at the top, and they had also triangular leaves that looked like little arrowheads sort of folded around the edges, very reddish. And then you come back over the next couple days, and then you notice the asparagus is bigger and bigger and bigger. And now it's looking a little bit more like small bamboo, and now it's looking a little bit more like big bamboo. And then you start to notice it's not just over there on that little island, it's also on the shore. And also, if you start looking, it's kind of just everywhere on the entire embankment. So then, you might not be surprised to find out, I had never encountered this plant before. I looked it up, and it's, anyone know? Japanese knotweed, yeah. So, if you've never encountered it before, and you don't know that you're supposed to hate it, It's very striking in its profusion. Again, I was reminded the first time I encountered bamboo when I was living in California. I didn't know I was supposed to hate it. And it's really fascinating that there would be these tiny little bamboo areas, and then you'd come back a month later, and they would be like 20 feet high and completely covering everything. And you would try to dig it out, and you couldn't even get the shovel in because the rhizomes were so thick, and it would just keep spreading and spreading. And it was a delightful little forest, I thought, because I wasn't on the grounds crew. I was on the maintenance crew, so I didn't have to worry about eradication. But the striking thing about knotweed is that it pulls you then into this other sense of presence, right? Another simplistic sense. We looked at the temporal sense of the now in deep time in the ephemeral, but also this sense of here, right? If you want to be present, you're here and now. To encounter knotweed, you have to go to specific places. It's not just anywhere. But the striking thing about it, right, is in its profusion of growth, there's this switchover point that was probably around mid to late June. There are these connected islands, these little rocky islands in the mid part of the stream up at High Falls that are quite large. They're, I don't know, probably a couple hundred feet and probably 20 feet across, that they went from having just a plant on them, knotweed on them, to just being knotweed. That's it. That's what they were. You couldn't see any rocks underneath them. It was just this huge profusion of green tracking down a couple hundred yards. Right? So very quickly, in engaging with this plant, you're forced into or invited into this way of seeing being here to the plant, not as something you're doing, but the plant itself makes what here is, right? It actually is creating the space that is in it. And then when you start to realize that, then this enables this capacity of, you can actually go into knotweed, right? Not go up to it. You can go into it. And then you start realizing, oh, you've been walking around in a High Falls forest. You think of the forest not merely as a location, but the here of what a forest is the thing that you enter into, right? The plant is not just there in the space. It is the here created by the plant itself. And in a more extended sense, right? The knotweed was over there on the bank, but to make sense of what knotweed is to make sense of where it is, how it's interrelated to these other spaces and allowances of its spaces, and how it might move in other places, right? This is what really concerns people, is they don't want to just know where, again, I didn't know that. I talked to people around here. They really hate it. They don't just want to know where it is. They want to see where it could be, right? They're worried about how year after year, it might take over all of these other things and make their knotweed here and just transform the whole world into a knotweed here, which seems to be perhaps its intention. But holding off from moral judgment on that. Again, when we have these poor dispossessed plants sitting in here, and it's kind of easy to think about houseplants as sort of the archetypal plant, and as though the plants out there are just houseplants that are planted out there, rather than there is not space in which things are. The location that you're in is the life that is there. That's true in most places that we tend to want to inhabit or are capable of inhabiting, is you're entering into whatever particular life is there, made by that transformed deep sense of space, not as a container, but as plant-enabled. And you can see, again, as I said with the trillium, it's not a matter of these are different lessons taught by each of the different plants on their own. But in the same way that you have all these different modes of time you can enter into, so trillium time is different than redwood time, is different from oak time, is different from aspen time, so for their places, right? To enter into an oak forest is very different from entering into a pine forest, right? Entering into a field is very different from entering into a valley. We all know this, but we tend to not combine it with our desire that we say we have to want to live in the present. We say, well, where are we when we are here? Where is here? Here, there is no here. There's many different heres depending on where we are and how we've entered into it and what we've allowed it to allow us to experience, let's say. I also spent some time at the Nature Institute. So right out here, you might know, if you come here in the summer, right where you park, there's a really nice milkweed patch over there. Now, it's just a bunch of sticks with a bunch of little curvy pods that have kind of exploded into seeds and are scattering themselves all over the place. But before that, earlier in the summer, they also started off in this swampy area, right? They tend to like water, a waterish type area. They're also interestingly, fascinatingly, like the trillium and like the knotweed, rhizomatic plants, which is a coincidence that the three that I chose happen to all be rhizomatic. I don't know why I am drawn to them. I suspect I know why, but I don't know for sure. And they also have a very similar type of growth pattern in certain ways to the Japanese knotweed. They have a very similar looking stem bamboo structure. It has the same kind of hollowness. The branching isn't, it's a little bit tighter to the stem, but overall from a distance they have kind of a similar growth feel. They have a similar time gestalt in the way that they grow. They grow in these clusters in similar ways. And yet they do something very striking at the end. At the end, when they come to the top, they send out not just any flowers, right? The knotweed flowers, and it's fine, right? They have this little extended flower structure with, you know, little wildflowers on them. They're fine. There's nothing wrong with them. But they're definitely not striking, right? When a milkweed comes to flower, you get this eruption explosion of these little firework kush balls that explode out on top, right? They're very, very appealing. They draw people, right? They actually, and they smell quite good. They draw you over to them. You're inclined to walk over and to want to be over and with them. They draw you over into this being as a presence. But what was striking to me in particular about the milkweed is I kept trying to work with this idea of metamorphosis in Goethe and other, it's a very common Goethean theme, right? So you try to feel the way that it is the same plant you're encountering. That's the basic idea, which sounds easy to say, but you say, what is there is the same. So every different appearance that you encounter is the appearance of the same thing. Again, sounds easy, until you actually try to feel that, right? When you do it with the trillium, it's, no offense to trillium, it's a lot less hard because you have this kind of easy repeating structure where the leaves look remarkably like the sepals and the sepals look remarkably like the petals. There's a little bit of change in color change and size change, but there's a much greater feeling of continuity of, oh yeah, I could see that trillium would do that, right? When you see the flower come out, you're not shocked and surprised. You're like, yeah, that makes sense for your character. But when you look at a milkweed, it has this incredibly straight trunk, these very simple leaves coming out like that, and then it comes up, and just utterly differently, it has these flowers explode all out. These little five-pointed structures, very fascinating, very complex structures. The structure of each individual little flower on the whole big inflorescence itself feels more complicated than all the rest of the plant together. And I can't feel the internal coherence of how they come out. Then, after that, right, so some of them get pollinated, and then you get these other things come out, the seed pods, which again feel like something that was taken and glued to the plant that's utterly discontinuous from it, right? If you hadn't seen beforehand, right, and you were shown just the vegetative growth, and then just the flower, and then just the seed pod, you wouldn't suspect that they were all of the same thing. And so what's particularly striking paradoxically about the milkweed is this demand to come into it as a unified being presenting itself in all of these different ways. So how can you come to feel the different appearances of the milkweed all as being different, equally authentic manifestations of the same underlying being, right? The challenge is put there by the milkweed precisely because it's so hard. But you see that it's the same thing. You don't merely say, well, I know plants have different parts. I know they have roots, and I know they have stems and leaves and flowers and fruits. And those are just different, and sometimes they look the same, and sometimes they look different. And that's ignoring the problem, rather than if you thought of a friend that you have, right, that has 50 different hobbies, and they have, as many of us probably have, right? You have like your six different friend groups, and you're sort of a different person in each of those friend groups, right? That's enabled by all those different ones. That's why you don't bring all your friends all together into the same room, because a lot of them would think that you're being disingenuous or borderline lying, right? Or they would say, that's not the Ryan I know. I've never experienced this personally. I have actually not. I got to keep them in. I actually keep them in different states. but of course, I'm not lying to any of them, right? Generally, I usually don't. But in a lot of ways, I am actually authentically presenting myself. But what is allowed to come to presence depends on the particular group of people that you're with. And the challenge then of somebody that would be studying me in a Goethean way would be, how are all of those equally authentic, non-lying presences when they don't seem to cohere with each other, right? So how can you feel the coming into presence as all manifestations of the same thing? A challenge. I'll tell a story. We lived in Rhode Island for a long time before we moved out here. And we went to, my wife and I, before our daughter was born, many years ago, a large national park there called Arcadia Management Area. It's a beautiful summer day, early spring, early June, and we were walking through, completely cloudless day, it was just blue skies, and we started walking through this forest, and it was beautiful, and then we started to hear it rain, and we're like, ah, shoot, I gotta go home. But then we walked out into a little clearing between two parts of the forest, and it was still blue skies, there were no clouds. And then, I was confused. And so we walked into the next part of the forest, and I was like, oh, shoot, it's raining again. And then I thought, well, I've experienced, you know, after a big thunderstorm, there's still water on the leaves, and so it'll still rain down a bit. But then we looked at the leaves, and all the leaves were dry, but it was still raining, which I found out after that, some of you might know, was not rain. Actually, it was what are now called spongy moth caterpillars defecating in such massive amounts that it sounded like rain the entire time we were in the forest. I had never heard of these things before. I went home, and what I Googled, what's happening when it sounds like it's raining in a forest, but it's not raining, and the first hit was spongy moth caterpillars. And I thought, huh, there must sure be a lot of them. I take it you've all encountered them as well. they're tough to not encounter. So we're moving now from the plant into the insect, and also moving into what we could call an ethical or a moral realm. And one of the striking things in moving from plants to insects, and one of the reasons that insects are attractive to me, is precisely because they're so unattractive to most people, right? Most people hate insects. The thing that we call them are bugs, because they bug us, and the poison that you use to kill them is just called pesticide. It's pest killers, because they're pests, because we don't like them. And then most people, right, when you're away from the insects, we don't like to admit that we don't like them, because that makes us sound like we're anti-nature people. But if I said, oh my goodness, don't go in that room, it's covered floor to ceiling with insects, you would stay out of that room. If I said, oh my goodness, that room is covered floor to ceiling with plants, you would say, oh cool, a greenhouse, neat, I will go in there, right? I'll do one more. Imaginative exercise. So imagine you encounter a regular oak, and I told you, right, you have this feeling of the stateliness and grandeur of an oak. And I said, imagine encountering something like that that's thousands of times bigger, right? And then we get on a plane and we go to the West Coast and we start to look at redwoods. That's appealing, right? That's incredibly drawing, this idea of this, when you hear a redwood described, you want to go. You want to see these redwood forests and these almost unimaginably massive living plant beings. If I said to you, oh my goodness, come with me to Montana. They have a tarantula out there that is thousands of times bigger than any tarantula you've ever seen. It's bigger than a house. You probably would not travel out there, right?
You're right.
One of the things I found is each of the lessons that you're taught when you are trying to enter into presence with specific beings is not just the specificity of the lesson, but a way the paradoxicalness of it, right? So you learn that eternity is the way to understand the now by a plant called the ephemeral, right? You understand the unity of presentation in a plant by trying to think about a milkweed. And you learn the idea of the present in the sense of a present, a gift given, by looking at a spongy moth. So a couple stories. So I was getting interested in plants and insects, and especially this metamorphic idea. And so I was spending a lot of time this summer looking at caterpillars, moss, and butterflies in particular. So I was just hunting a lot with my daughter for caterpillars, right? And when you start hunting with them, one of the really striking things about insects as opposed to plants is that they are much harder to find, right? When the plants, once you find one, it kind of just stays there, and you can go back to here whenever now is convenient to you. But if you find a caterpillar here, you can't just return whenever now is convenient to you. You kind of have to follow it around. And so it gets exciting when you find them, right? So I would be hunting around for hours and I'd finally find one. And then one day we were hunting and we found one and we collected it and we brought it back home and we had it in its little habitat with some different things for it to try to figure out what it likes to eat. And my daughter was so excited, and it was this little black caterpillar with these rows of two spots running all down its spine. About half of them were red, right? So the top had a series of two spots, all red. Bottom, all blue, and then it had these vaguely yellowy hairs on the side. So red, yellow, and blue. My daughter got really excited and she named it Primary. So this insect, right, this caterpillar, was so special to us that it got a proper name of its own. Capital P, Primary. I didn't know what it was. So I was out looking later that week, and I found a second primary. And I found a second primary, and I was so excited. I was like, oh my goodness, I need to tell my daughter I found another one. And so I got it, and I put it in a little cage, and I brought it home to her. And then the next day I was looking, and I found a third one, and a fourth one, and a fifth one. And then it turns out I was walking down to the farm store, and there were about 3 to 8 primaries on any leaf that you look at, and it turns out there were just hundreds and thousands of these caterpillars all over the place. My immediate response, because again, I mean, I knew that people didn't care for spongy moths, but I was so excited. My immediate response, because I had been hunting for so long to find such profusion, was actually incredible gratefulness and gratitude that now it was so easy to find them. They were all over the place, and I could easily take them and watch them turn into, well, form their cocoons, right? Because they turn into moths. So my immediate experience of them as caterpillars was grateful to them as a gift, which again is an easy, when you try to enter into presence, it's a lot easier to start experiencing insects or animals as present, as gift to us, than plants. So just think about, I mean, deer are like this until you live in this area for too long, right? But for most people, I was driving around the other day and somebody had pulled off to the side of the road and they were taking photographs and everybody was out of the car and really excited. I'm like, what are they doing? And I looked over and there was a deer on the other side of the road and they were pointing and nudging each other. And I was like, oh, they're from the city. They haven't learned to stop appreciating deer as gifts. But if any of us saw a bald eagle fly overhead, you wouldn't just say, oh, neat, there's a bald eagle here and now, and it's having a particular appearance. You would experience that with gratefulness as a gift that was given to you, right? And so you have this invitation to join into this moral sense of being present to individual living beings, paradoxically spongy moths that are not only insects, but considered to be horrible invasive pests, right? People do not like them. But you can still experience it even then as a gift. One more quick story. So the spongy moths, they're now called spongy moths because they're laid in little egg cases that look like little white bits of sponge, right, stuck to the sides of trees as eggs. And then out of those come hundreds and hundreds of tiny little first instar caterpillars. And then they just kind of swarm around in these groups, right? They're these huge little clusters that swarm from place to place. And then when they go to cocoon, they cocoon in these little swarms. You might have seen them, right? So it's these overall netting, and then inside of it is, you know, dozens to sometimes hundreds of little cocoons. I pulled into the Nature Institute one day, and I had a couple other caterpillars I was looking at where it was really hard to find them, and just finding one and getting it to actually pupate and become a chrysalis or form into a cocoon was very exciting because it's so hard to find them, and I kept losing a lot to parasitic wasps. They kept getting in there. And so just seeing the emergence pattern, I was hungry for it, and I pulled in and I came out, and it was 8:30 in the morning, and it was this early morning, you know, light mist, kind of yellowish light, and I walked out and the spongy moss had just all started emerging as moss. And so when I walked out, there were just thousands and thousands of them all fluttering around. And so again, you had this experience of the way that you feel of entering into a presence of moths. Not coming up and encountering one, they have now shaped this space in this numinous, interesting, ethereal experience that was very hard to not learn to take as a gift. Lastly, but not leastly, everybody's favorite, the monarch butterfly. Probably immediately when I say that, one of the first things you think of is, man, we really need some more milkweed because they are getting really endangered at this point and super hard to find. I spent a huge amount of time this summer out in the milkweed patch hunting for a monarch caterpillar. Just hours out there looking, and I did not find them. Week after week after week after week, I didn't find a single one. I couldn't find any eggs. And then finally, one day, I found one. One little guy. And I was very excited. I immediately took him and I put him in a terrarium with some tasty milkweed for it. And it ate and ate and ate and got gigantic. And I was so excited that I watched it for a very long time because, again, it's very hard when you start looking for something and you find it, it's very hard to not appreciate it as a gift, right? It's the Easter egg principle or the Christmas principle. You can wrap anything up in wrapping paper, even stuff you already own, right? My parents did this sometimes. They would take a couple toys that we already had that they thought that I had not appreciated, and they would wrap them. And then when you unwrap them at Christmas, they actually felt special again, right? Because they got represented to you as something actually to be enjoyed. And the monarchs are so easy to take that way in general, but especially because they're endangered. And they're beautiful at every stage, right? The caterpillar is quite striking, but the monarch chrysalis is particularly dazzling, if nobody's seen it. So it's the chrysalis too. I also didn't know this before. The chrysalis is not formed by the caterpillar. So the caterpillars that turn into butterflies pupate as a chrysalis. The caterpillars that turn into moss pupate as a cocoon. Cocoons are made out of silk. They're wrapped around, so the moss caterpillar has a gland that produces silk that can make this cocoon. What you see as a chrysalis, the things that will turn into a butterfly, is actually the final exoskeleton underneath the last shedding of the caterpillar. So it hangs itself upside down, and when it wriggles out of its final skin that then falls to the ground, what's underneath is not another bigger caterpillar, it's a chrysalis. So it wriggles out of its final, and what you have there at the end is this monarch chrysalis that's this perfect little emerald, beautiful green jewel. Some other chrysalises are nice. It's particularly beautiful. Then it's a very uniform green. After a couple days, it starts to develop this uniform black band around it, and then starts to develop all of these perfectly little symmetrical gold flecks, almost as though it's decorating itself. I was looking up frequently asked questions about monarchs, and it's all the stuff that you'd expect about migration patterns and why they like milkweed and nothing else. And then one of the frequently asked questions is, what's the deal with the gold spots? And the answer was, we have no idea what those are for. We don't know what the function is, why they're there, why they show up after a while, why they're there and not on other ones. Who knows? And then finally it emerges, of course, into this incredibly beautiful butterfly with a very fascinating life pattern where it has several generations. And then for some reason, as a butterfly, decides to fly down to central Mexico, thousands of miles away. What you learn easily, non-paradoxically, from the caterpillar and the chrysalis and the full-grown butterfly, also called the imago, which delights me to no end, of the monarch is this sense of present that we normally think of attentiveness, right? So being present to something is, again, a moral position that we have to create in ourselves and bring ourselves out. So we know when we're ready to pay attention to something and when we're not, right? So there's been several movies that are these really long 3-hour epics, right? Or these like beautiful, interesting foreign films that a friend will say, do you want to watch this? And I'll say, I'm not in the mood. And by that, I mean, I don't have the attention to bring to meet it where it is, right? This idea of attention that we began with. But what the monarch teaches, I think, in this sense of presence as bringing ourself presence, the sense of deep attention, is contained within this idea of attention, is tending, right? So that when you attend to something, you don't merely pay mental attention to it, you are drawn into a relationship of care with it. So you don't just attend to your garden, you tend your garden. So the first thing that a lot of people think when they see milkweed, and one of the reasons besides its intrinsic beauty that people like milkweed and plant it around, is because they're trying to tend to the monarchs. They're trying to create a path of migration to allow them to subsist coming back and forth. And it's an easy lesson to learn from the monarch, but then, like with all the other ones, you take it back through and say, well, then what's the quality of attention that's a form of tending when we're thinking about spongy moths? Do we tend them just by trying to eradicate them? What about Japanese knotweed? What's our form of attention? Do we attend to it just to learn how to dig it out in a better pesticide? Or what is the proper way of living with it, right? Of being present with it? Especially, I mean, I don't own property out here yet, but that's a very serious question for a lot of people. It's easy to say, love all the plants, when they're not taking over everything, right? Another plant that I considered doing is poison ivy, which I personally am incredibly highly allergic to and have spent many weeks in bed in my life because I accidentally touched some of it, right? So if I see it, I want to eradicate it. What's a way of attending to it that's attending to it that isn't merely an eradication of it, right? And so we feel called then by all these different particulars into a form, as I said at the beginning, of infinity, where each of them has its own particular way that we need to pay attention to it. So being present to a monarch is not the same thing as being present to a spongy moth, is not the same way of being present to a black swallowtail, is not the same way of being present to a tiger. Imagine that. If there were an actual tiger in this room, our mode of presence would be absence. So what does that look like for each of the different beings? And carrying to this sense of depth, that when you enter into presence, you want to enter into it, not separate it out from other things. Thank you for your time and attention.
We hope that you've enjoyed this presentation. We'd love to hear what you think. You can write to us at info@natureinstitute.org with your comments and suggestions. You can become a subscriber and download a PDF version of all the back issues of In Context, our twice-yearly publication, along with many books, essays, and podcasts on our webpage, natureinstitute.org. Thanks for listening.